previous summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump gained headlines but changed little.
With the dispatch of his North Korean nuclear envoy to the U.S. this week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in clearly recognizes time's not on his side, with a presidential election here slated to replace him next March. For U.S. President Joe Biden, however, the North Korean nuclear issue competes on a crowded agenda, with Washington's recent withdrawal from Afghanistan and a surge in COVID-19 cases in the U.S.
Still, the South Korean president seems determined to bring the U.S. and North Korea closer to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians held a demonstration protesting the Israeli illegal policies against Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. The protest aimed at expressing solidarity with Palestinian detainees under hunger strike and demanding the release of Anhar Dik, a Palestinian woman who is expected to give birth in an Israeli jail.
Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails face bad treatment as most of them are detained with no clear charge or trial. Most of the detainees suffer from serious diseases and live in bad health conditions. Amid the medical negligence of the Israeli army, Anhar's is in critical condition as she is expected to give birth in a few days. The international community should be held accountable for the fate of Anhar and her baby.
Anhar is also suffering from pregnancy bipolar depression and afraid for her baby's fate in Israeli prison. The family of the pregnant Palestinian woman jailed by Israel appealed for the international community to set her free to give birth outside prison.
We held this rally to highlight the issue of our Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is going to give birth inside Israeli jails. We call on human rights groups to stand up behind Anhar. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from inhuman Israeli policies. There must be a serious action by the world community.
Eight former Palestinian prisoners gave birth to their children inside the Israeli prisons. Statistics say that out of 39 Palestinian women imprisoned in Israeli jails, 12 are mothers.
This rally aims to send a clear message of solidarity to the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is pregnant and deprived of any medical care. We put the blame on the international community that remains silent in front of these violations against Palestinian detainees.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees. Palestinian here demand an end to the Israeli policies and detention against Palestinians, especially pregnant women. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Utter panic has once again gripped Rohingya refugee camps across India amid ongoing COVID crisis. The community is facing yet another campaign for possible deportation, with the government calling them a threat to national security and accusing them of being involved in illegal activities.
From social networks to politicians to TV debates, we are being portrayed as villains, sometimes illegal immigrants. The only reason is our faith, otherwise there are thousands of refugees here. Why are we being treated indifferently? We just want to stay alive rather than being killed in Myanmar.
Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against them has been haunting the community. The UN refugee agency responsible to support these refugees in India is of no help, they say. Activists say the most urgent need for these refugees is food, water, healthcare services, and other basic essentials, rather than a deliberate attempt to target them.
It has been 9 years we are here just to save our lives. We want to go home, but do you think situation there is appropriate for us. We have time and again cooperated with the Indian government in every possible way. We urge India to treat us on humanitarian ground, not on faith. Our case is in the Supreme Court, which is our only hope.
Most of the refugees work as daily wages to make a living, but the recent government restrictions and COVID lockdown have left many out of work. Now the community is struggling on its own to survive. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India. However, since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government in India, the destitute community has become victims of an expulsion campaign. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress. Sometimes detentions in a midnight raids. Sometimes their camps being burnt mysteriously. All they want is a peaceful survival in the world's largest democracy till the situation gets conducive in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis around the world, the community continues to be neglected, but they say they haven't lost hope on Indian democracy despite all hardships. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously.
Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the U.S.-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan.
During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil.
As the US finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the US, but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government after taking almost full control of war-torn Afghanistan. The Taliban have pledged to form an inclusive government and respect human rights and women's freedom within their version of the Islamic law. Taliban sources say the group's co-founder and head of political office, Mullah Barodar, will lead the new government in Afghanistan. The EU foreign policy chief says the bloc will engage with the Taliban in order to support the Afghan people, but it does not mean it will recognize a new government there. The United Nations has resumed its humanitarian flights to northern and southern Afghanistan, enabling scores of humanitarian organizations to continue life-saving activities there. The U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops before the end of August deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul, is our correspondent, Amin Alimi, with all the latest developments in Afghanistan. Amin.
Well, Badia, a blame game is underway in Afghanistan, particularly here in the Afghan capital on the issue of Panjshir. Taliban sources, mainly its field commanders, say that we have successfully captured the entire Panjshir province in northeastern part of Afghanistan. But in the meantime, Ahmed Massoud, as well as Amrullah Saleh, who are leading the resistance front in northern Panjshir province of Afghanistan, have also released separate message saying that, insisting that we are inside Panjshir and that we have not left this key area and that we are going to resist against the Taliban until we gain victory against these troops. According to Amrullah Saleh, as well as according to a tweet by Ahmed Massoud, who is the leader of Northern Resistance Front, a propaganda has been launched by the enemy of the National Resistance Front in order to gain more morale for the defeated fighters around Panjshir province. This comes as the Taliban earlier had said that we are in full control of Panjshir. In the meantime, some top political leaders, mainly Abdullah, former chief of Afghanistan's High Reconciliation Council, as well as Hamid Karzai, the former Afghan president, are doing their best here in Kabul to convince both sides in order to approve a ceasefire that will that should lead both sides to resume negotiations in order to reach a peaceful agreement.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Alimi joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. We're joining us on tonight's Spotlight. We have writer and blogger, social activist, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Mr. Sayed Muaz Shah, joining us from Karachi. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Shahid Qureshi, who's joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Muaz Shah in Karachi. As we know, the Taliban are set to announce a new government soon. What are your expectations, having in mind the promises that they've made about being an inclusive government?
I think this is an interesting place to start because, you know, as you know, the news was that today we were going to get some sort of insight to that. But I think the activities and recent events in Panjshir Valley have kind of stalled that announcement. But as you stated earlier, there are sources, reliable sources, that have reported that Mullah Brother would be the head of this new government. Along with that, there's some indication of the former leadership, including Mullah Yaqub, who may come in a second tier of leadership as well. But when I think about the inclusive nature of the government, I think there was some discussion, obviously, that's been going on from the beginning with Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah. And there was a source that recently disclosed that, you know, with Hamid Karzai, he, you know, in quote unquote, is an old horse, and that they were probably not going to engage him in an official capacity. That is yet to be seen. But that Abdullah is someone that they would probably most likely engage in some sort of discussion. And we see that clearly in the, as you indicated, that they are the mid-go-level people negotiating between the Panjshir Valley resistance and the Taliban. So the Taliban have some sort of trust that they're able to come out with a negotiated solution. As you know, that they have been negotiating with the Panjshir Valley elders for quite some time, for weeks, in fact, even before the Americans left. And there was a movement to that. But there was a lot of discussion. Some of the discussion that came to fore that was recently reported was that one of the negotiating elements was that the Panjshir Valley resistance was requesting somewhere around 30% of the ministerial seats, which was something that the Taliban just would not accept. And that's why we're seeing what we see. And if you even watched Amanullah Saleh's own tweet and Twitter account before today's tweet, he recently actually tweeted about how the Taliban had cut the electricity and the internet connection. And in fact, if you actually observe very carefully in Amanullah Saleh's video that recently, that you were referring to, that they're still there, you can hear the humming of a diesel generator in the background. So it's quite possible that they're still there, but I think one of the key things is that there has been significant change in the Panjshir Valley. We'll find tomorrow morning what the situation is. It may not have entirely fallen, but Taliban most likely, through all the sources, do indicate they have made significant gains there.
All right, Mr. Qureshi in London, what about pledges by countries to engage with the Taliban? There's Russia, there's China, there are other countries in the region. The British Foreign Secretary says there's a need to engage with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The EU Foreign Policy Chief says a bloc will engage with the Taliban, but it doesn't mean it will recognize a new government there. What will be the extent and nature of these relationships, in your opinion?
Well, thank you. It's a good question. What I believe is that what are the challenges the current victors of the current war against the occupying forces of colonialists who were occupying Afghanistan for the last 20 years. The challenge is that they have activated their tools like IMF, World Bank. They've frozen their assets to make this government to fail. So what needs to happen is the neighboring countries which you just mentioned, including Pakistan and Iran, for example, Uzbekistan and Russia and China, they should come forward and make sure there's no shortage of food supplies to the people of Afghanistan, because they have been suffering for the last 20 years of these great game. With regards to the international pledges, I mean, they are the losers who are making all these pledges. And as I said before, the tiger won't lose his sleep over the opinion of a sheep. These people have fought with nothing, and they won the war. The war cost to those people who are making pledges $3 trillion, 5,000 or 20,000 injured. So the question is whether does it really matter to the people who are in power at the moment? The answer is no, it doesn't. But as a matter of legitimacy, and I think it's a good time that the people or the countries should define what does it mean to be called international community. I mean, 3-4 countries who get together and calling themselves international community. We have more than 200 countries in the world. So when we should use the word international community, that's also a very important question. With regards to Amirullah Saleh and Ahmed Massoud, I think in any ideal situation, these people should be put on trial for war crimes and collaborating with the invaders and occupiers. They are traitors. These people have committed crimes against humanity, against their own people. They were collaborating people who were killing civilians and vettings in drone attacks. This guy, they're calling some resistance forces. They're thieves. They're responsible for stealing the money of the state. As we have seen, the president of with whom Amirullah Saleh has been and Ahmed Massoud have been enjoying the support of those occupiers.
Sure.
For the last 20 years. They have no right to come forward and call themselves resistance. They are criminals, basically. They should be put on trial. In any ideal situation, the people who should be put on trial is the Dostum, who was responsible for killing its own people. They were Afghans. It's irrelevant if they were Taliban or whatever faction they belong to. But the way the Dostum treated, and these people, Amirullah Saleh especially, he's an Indian stooge, basically. He's a spoiler. He's an ungrateful man who's been accusing Pakistan for a long time. He's an ungrateful man who was blaming Pakistan, who is hosting 3 million of his countrymen for the last 40 years. These people are...
Let's bring in Mr. Moaz Shah back into the discussion. Sorry to interrupt you there. Mr. Moaz Shah, what about the extent and the nature of a U.S.-Taliban relationship? That, too, is one of the key issues that needs to be worked out. Like, for example, the U.S. Treasury Department, it says restrictions on Taliban access to the international financial system remains in place. Do you think that's being used as some form of leverage at this point?
Oh, I think definitely it's a political leverage and very relevant. In fact, I think it's almost suicide for Joe Biden to kind of even take us off even a little angle. Right now, his approval ratings are the worst he's ever witnessed in his presidency. So they're going to tread very carefully on that $9 billion that they have in Afghanistan government's money and to release that. And I think that's going to be attached with possibly commitments, certain action items that the Taliban government, I think everybody's waiting really when the Taliban government will be announced officially. And one thing I just wanted to add from Pakistan's side, today's Shah Mahmood Qureshi, the foreign minister, said that we will recognize an Afghanistan government that represents the Afghanistani people. And our commitment is to the people of Afghanistan. So if, again, going to what the previous speaker mentioned about how the country has come in support of the Taliban in a more broader framework than the existing Kabul regime, I think that's going to play out, and that may, we may see the recognition, particularly as you noticed just earlier this week, the Chinese were considered the best friends for the Taliban, and they and the Russians didn't close down their embassies. So there are indications that are very clear. Pakistan also has, the border points at some levels open for humanitarian reasons, and I think we will see probably the regional players in Asia from the Chinese and the Russians primarily first, and then followed by Pakistan, and I believe Iran as well will recognize this government. And I think the Taliban are open to this inclusion of elements of the previous regime and government, but those who have clean hands. And as the previous speaker said, unfortunately, a lot of the leadership and people who are in power have records of corruption. If you even remember, Abdul Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah were live loggerheads in the previous election, and they had to kind of come to an agreement because of, you know, many accusations. And so I think that we will see Abdullah Abdullah definitely play a significant role, along with some other leaders, as well as we see Taliban have been more inclusive. In fact, the very commander who is leading the Taliban effort in the Panjshir Valley is a Tajik. And so Taliban have become sensitive to including within their framework other ethnicities, including the Hazara minority. And I think this time the Taliban have a wider mandate that comes with support from all sections of society. And that's because,
right,
unfortunately, the hearts and minds were not won by the U.S. occupational forces of the Kabul regime. And Taliban, in turn, in my opinion, in the past 20 years, have inherently won the hearts and minds.
Talking about hearts and minds, Mr. Qureshi in London, American intelligence assessments, they claim they didn't foresee such a rapid collapse of the Afghan military. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said Britain's intelligence assessment was that it was unlikely Kabul would fall this year. Why did the Taliban sweep across the country much more quickly than expected?
Well, I think this is the second failure of the U.S. Intelligence and U.S. security system in the last 20 years. They failed on the 9/11. The 15 intelligence agencies, including the U.S. Air Force, completely failed on the day of the 9/11, and they failed to stop those terrorists committing atrocities against the civilians. And then after 20 years spending $3 trillion, they failed again. And that shows that this war was not a war. It was more of a scandal of the war military industrial complex, where they found a spot where they can create a conflict, and then they were selling or they were sending military equipment which was not needed in that type of war. In guerrilla warfare, you don't need tanks and Humvees and all these equipments. They send it to Afghanistan. But they were, because they were producing those, and the shareholders were getting rich. And I think it is, I must appreciate President Biden, although people are criticizing him, to take this brave step. Because in damage control, you do not wait for the right time. You just stop where you are, and then you move back and step back. And I think the President Biden has, and also President Trump, made the right decision. They did introspection, because the U.S. infrastructure itself, the roads, the bridges, their own infrastructure is in need, and they need about $2 trillion, because in the last 50 years, they haven't spent enough money on that. With regards to the failure of the intelligence, that shows that the two countries who live in the movies, that is India, who live in Bollywood, and then the Americans who live in Hollywood. So their heroes are these Rambos and so on the ground, the failure of intelligence, it shows they were relying too much on the electronic gadgetry than having a proper on the ground, on the field a kind of intelligence and proper assessment.
Okay.
Falling of Afghanistan, falling of Kabul in 36 hours, which they said it's going to be taking 6 months, is a complete failure. In any kind of situation, the boss will sack all those people who were sending those false reports, false assessments back home. And I think in any kind of business model, if you have these kind of employees who are not performing, who spend too much money, and the money disappeared into offshore safe havens, in banks, and the Wall Street is obviously responsible for all this death and destruction and war profiteering, as well as the I must say that this, the Western media especially keep on talking about the rights of the women and the rights of the children. I don't know why they don't talk about the rights of women in Palestine, why they don't talk about the rights of women and children in Kashmir.
Very good point,
indeed. They are selective in that way.
Mr. Mohan Shah, when Joe Biden, he took over the White House, he claimed that the U.S. is once again a reliable partner. He also boasted that, quote-unquote, America is back. But the U.S. decided to leave Afghanistan without much warning or any consultation with its allies. What does the disastrous fallout in Afghanistan say about Joe Biden's claims?
It's a PR effort by Biden to try to salvage the situation. Of course, he's kind of playing off what Trump making America great again. So he is trying to do that, but unfortunately, this is not going to go down well. It is an international embarrassment that will go down in the history of man. As the Taliban, again, you know, you may have the watches, we have the time, and clearly they have demonstrated that throughout the centuries, from stopping the British early on, and then the Russians, and now the Americans. It's only a repeated cycle that even Biden admitted in his press conference in July that this is a graveyard of nations, and I'm not going to, you know, allow the United States to join that. But unfortunately, that was 20 years too late. So I think one of the things that Biden is attempting to do, which unfortunately is not going to be very successful, it's just a sad reality, even though it may have been the right decision, as the fellow speaker was mentioning, it is a costly one politically, because there is no win for Biden here. I mean, there's a loss, and the money that we're talking about, $2 trillion and counting, most of it was spent on the military hardware. More than half of that money was spent on the American military machine. Over $1 trillion was just on that. And we're talking about equipment for just the Americans, not the Afghan army or any of them. And if you look at the development funds, I think there's some numbers indicate that only $4 billion. So all these things about women's rights and this focus area was never a focus. And if anybody can open just a cursory review of where the $2 trillion were spent, if you spent even like twice as much that they currently spent, Afghanistan might have rapidly even developed further. But their focus was not that. As President Truman said many years ago, to be careful of, and Eisenhower during their time, that we should be careful of this military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, it has come to haunt America again and again with their adventures. And again, that's filling the pocketbooks of certain people. And again, if you, you know, I just ask the viewers and whoever's listening, just go and examine where those $2 trillion actually went. And just a minuscule amount went to development for the Afghan people. So I think Joe Biden, it's a PR stunt. It's not going to work because the Republicans are hounding. You see Trump, all of a sudden now he's coming out into making comments and speeches. Before he was very silent. And we might even see Trump come back into the White House as a result of this. So we'll see how this plays out. But I think that Biden is in a tough pickle. And I don't think there's a win situation for him either, let alone the Afghanistan debacle.
Shahid Qureshi, President Biden, he forcefully rejected criticism of his decision to end America's 20-year war in Afghanistan. And he declared the end of an era in which the United States uses military power to remake other countries, in his own words. The end of an era, it ended on a very low note, if the end of an era was Afghanistan. Do you think Washington has learned its lesson here?
Well, I think it's a good question. If you don't learn the lesson, you will have the same results what you have. With the situation the United States is finding itself in is will be the same if they do the same thing elsewhere. So what needs to happen here is, and I think it's very hypocritical, we're not going to recognize the Taliban government. You've been negotiating with them in Qatar by bypassing the legitimate, so-called legitimate government of Ashraf Ghani more than 2 years. So where was your, that we don't deal with terrorists, we don't talk to them? You have been talking to them. You signed an agreement with them to the very people you call terrorists. So that's one point. The other point, I think we shouldn't put too much into the PR what President Biden is doing. Everybody knows what the reality is, and the U.S. public, and especially the U.S. media, is totally a war media. It's run by the Wall Street, as President Trump has suggested a few times, and that was one of the reasons President Trump was thrown out, because the establishment there was most of its security. If they looked at the internal problem U.S. was facing, how many homeless people they have, how many bank and financial scandals the United States has, they wouldn't be in this problem. But the problem is in the last 50 years, I see, that they have been distracting the internal problems, and they have been creating all these. For example, they spent about $6 trillion. I was hearing somewhere in Iraq. Iraq has nothing to do with Al Qaeda or any kind of terrorists. And the same is in Syria and in Yemen. So they are having these good terrorists and bad terrorists. It sounds like a same script, and they are repeating over and over again. But the real cost which people paid are the U.S. veteran. And I must admit that a soldier is a soldier, no matter which country they belong to. And those soldiers who were fighting this war in the name of defending the country, but in actual fact, they were defending the corrupt regime of capitalists or those financial mafia which is running the United States in military industrial complex, which moved all the manufacturing industry to China and somewhere else. And they have no, they are a consumer society at the moment. There's no hardware manufacturing available in the United States. If United States was a person, nobody will give you £1 as a loan, because the U.S. debt has crossed that ceiling many times.
Okay.
The U.S. deficit has gone too high. And these are the things which media or U.S. media and international media is not talking about. It. Taliban don't care who recognize
right.
them or who don't. What really matters is the people who are living in that region. And by taking these kind of action, the United States is further alienating itself from that region.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump in there, Mr. Wadeshi. Apologies. We are fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, Director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Said Muaz Shah, joining us from Karachi. Thanks to journalist and political analyst Shad Wadeshi, joining us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The Justice Department will tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and staff. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Charlie Savage. The piece is titled, Justice Department Will Toughen Rules for Seizing Lawmakers' Data, Garland Says. Justice Department may tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and their staff. Later in the day, Merrick Garland also met with leaders of the New York Times, CNN, and the Washington Post, after the disclosure of the Trump Justice Department had secretly seized phone records of reporters at each outlet in search of their sources. President Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland have said that prosecutors will no longer be permitted to use that tactic. The two events underscored how recent revelations displaying the power of prosecutors to secretly seize records from phone and technology companies for leak investigations have become a major political headache for the Biden-era Justice Department, even as many questions remain about the context. David McGraw, a New York Times newsroom lawyer who attended the meeting with his publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, portrayed the discussion about restricting the ability of leak hunters to go after reporters' data as positive. Under an agreement, news executives were permitted to disclose what they said, but Attorney General Merrick Garland's responses were off the record. In today's meeting, we once again sought a full accounting of what happened and requested that the Department of Justice codify that it will no longer seize journalists' records during leak investigations, Mr. Sulzberger said in a statement. We were encouraged by Attorney General Merrick Garland's statements, but we will continue to push until our concerns are addressed. The meeting came hours after Attorney General Merrick Garland had addressed the political uproar over the subpoena for congressional information, which the New York Times reported last week. He said he had asked his deputy, Lisa O'Monico, to review and toughen the department's existing policies for obtaining records of the legislative branch, noting that she was already working on surfacing potentially problematic matters deserving high-level review. Mr. Garland added, consistent with our commitment to the rule of law, we must ensure that full weight is accorded to separation of powers concerns moving forward. That announcement came as John C. Demers, the Trump administration official who leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, which oversees leak investigations, told his staff that he would step down at the end of next week. On Sunday, Democratic lawmakers had called for John C. Demers to testify about a subpoena that swept in congressional information, along with the former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and the former Attorney Generals Jeff Sessions and William Barr. But on Monday, 14th of June, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, denounced those calls, saying that an investigation by the Justice Department's independent inspector general was sufficient. By calling for a congressional inquiry, he said, top Democrats gave in to the urge to pick at the scab of politically motivated investigations. The Department of Justice is empowered to investigate criminal conduct by members of Congress and their staff. Necessarily, this sort of investigation is subject to strict procedural protections, Mitch McConnell said. The department's inspector general is fully equipped to determine whether these procedures were followed. I'm confident that the existing inquiry will uncover the truth. He also said that it was particularly disappointing that our colleagues are attacking Bill Barr over investigative decisions that occurred when he wasn't there yet. The grand jury subpoena that swept up congressional information was dated February 2018, when Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein were still the top two officials in the Justice Department. Still, after William Barr was sworn in the following year, the New York Times has reported, he brought in a trusted prosecutor with little relevant experience to help reinvigorate several leaked cases, including that involved congressional Democrats and their staff. Eventually, it was shut down without charges. Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the number two Democrat who has supported calling for former Attorney General to testify, pushed back at Mitch McConnell's suggestion that there was nothing amiss, asking, how would he know that? Senator Richard Durbin, who is also the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, sent a letter signed by the other 10 Democrats on that panel to Merrick Garland on Monday, asking for a copy of the subpoena and internal emails and other records related to it, and posing questions about its basis and purpose. Subpoena appears to have been part of a leak investigation that centered on a Democratic aide on the House Intelligence Committee. The New York Times has previously reported that it's listed 109 phone numbers and email addresses and sought account data linked to those numbers. Two lawmakers, Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both Democrats of California, were among those whose account information Apple turned over, along with aides and a relative of Adam Schiff's. The broad subpoena appears to have been an example of a common technique investigators use when they obtain the communications records of a target. By subpoenaing electronic communication providers for any account information linked to those phone numbers or email addresses, they can identify the people with whom the target interacted. For example, many people own a smartphone that uses either Apple or Google's operating systems and register their phone numbers with one of those companies when setting up their devices. Those accounts may also have their names, addresses, email addresses, data about the phone and computer hardware they use to access the account, and sometimes even credit card numbers. While the controversies over secret Trump-era seizures of data about reporters and about lawmakers and their staff have partly emerged, there is an important difference. The phone data seized about reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN centered on a type of metadata, calling logs, that reveals whom people have spoken with. The Justice Department also carried out a related legal fight over a court order it obtained for logs of the reporters' emails, which can also reveal social contacts that spilled into the Biden era and included gag orders imposed on executives at the New York Times and CNN. By contrast, there is no sign that the subpoena to Apple could have provided investigators with the type of metadata that would offer a systematic look at the lawmakers' contacts with other people. According to law enforcement officials, prosecutors cannot use a grand jury subpoena to obtain email logs. Instead, they obtain court orders if they want to seize the information logging senders and recipients of emails and other types of electronic messages. Apple, which is not a phone company and does not generate traditional calling logs, has said it turned over only account subscriber information in response to the grand jury and that it did not provide any content such as emails or pictures.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.